So, I probably should have asked you this right before I started recording, but now it's too late. So here we are. So you changed your name,
Yeah.
but you haven't changed your playwright name, or you're thinking about it, or you're like, what am I supposed to call you on this podcast? Like,
I
the name
don't
Stephen Brown is on
know.
everything I've published in the last months.
I don't know. I mean, my first decision that I made is I was like, I'm just going to change my name and I'll keep my playwriting name for the people who know me as a playwright. And then I was like, I don't think many people know me as a playwright.
I do. Hey, man, there are Stephen Brown fans out there, okay? Don't you disrespect us. Everyone, this is Timothy Mark Davis. You might know me just better as Tim. I am the producing artistic director for New City Players. I also had the great pleasure of producing and directing and playing Chet in our podcast series, scripted podcast series, Little Montgomery, that we just finished up this past week. There's five episodes of it now available on all major podcasting platforms. And this episode is a conversation that I had recently with the playwright who I have had the great pleasure of becoming friends with over the last couple of years, Stephen Brown. And so this is a conversation with me and him, an interview. We talk about playwriting. We talk about the process of adapting Little Montgomery into a podcast. We talk about where the play came from. And we kind of get into a little bit about what is the future of audio plays and how could they be a part of what we do as theater artists. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I really love Stephen just as a person and as a writer. And he just crushes this interview. He came ready. I didn't send him any questions ahead of time or anything. He came ready to answer some questions, ready to play ball. So please enjoy my conversation with playwright Stephen Brown.
But then I thought, I was like, but the people who do know me as a playwright, like they know me as a person as well.
That's
you
true.
know, like I'm not gonna hit you up as Stephen Fran Smith and you're like, I don't know who the hell this guy is, I'm not gonna answer his emails. Like I have your phone number, you know, like I could text you.
Yeah, I'm just gonna, every time you text me, I'll be like, sorry, is this Stephen Brown or Stephen Fran Smith?
Oh my God.
I'm just going to turn it into a bit that never ends, and
I
eventually you
believe
hate
you
me.
that you'll do that. Actually, this is a totally tangential story that you could keep here if you want or not.
Okay.
When I was in college, I had a roommate, and he was a really great guy. His name was Patty. And he asked me one day, he was like, Steven, do you have any nicknames? And I was like, no. He's like, really? You've never had a nickname before? I was like, no, I don't think so. And he was like, all right. I'm gonna do this. He's like, I'm gonna give you the nickname Dr. Brown, and I'm gonna tell you right now that I'm giving you the nickname for no reason at all, and I'm gonna get everyone on campus to call you Dr. Brown in like 2 weeks. I was like, whatever,
My
man.
God.
2 weeks later, everyone is calling me Dr. Brown.
No
There's no
way.
backstory other than he wanted to do it. And what happened is my best friend from high school visited me on campus, heard the nickname. He came to live with me when I moved to New York and was calling me the nickname. So my roommates in New York started calling me the nickname. And now people still call me Dr. Brown intermittently in my life. That was like 12 years ago.
Just from the sheer force of one man's will.
Yeah. And I believe you to be a very similar person, Tim. So
Well,
when
like
you
you
say you'll
just
make it a bit, I believe
I don't know. You told me that story and I got like physically excited.
That's what I'm
Not
talking about.
sexually, physically excited. Like I am so thrilled that someone could make this happen. I want to be that person. So
Oh, it was
yeah, you
brilliant.
Oh, so good. Okay, so well for today, Stephen Brown, Stephen Ferran Smith. Is Ferran Smith, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, that was perfect.
Okay. So your name on all of our Little Montgomery materials and on our website, just everywhere, is Stephen Brown. So that's how people are gonna recognize you who've been listening to the podcast. You are our playwright. You're our series writer, our scripted series writer. I don't even know what to call you. You are also basically executive producer, which I didn't credit you as because I don't want to give you too much power because I'm an egomaniac. But you, I mean, you were there for so many rehearsals. You and me were going back and forth on the script in those early weeks. The scenes that I was acting in, you basically directed. You directed me. You were giving tons of good feedback and advice. You were very involved in this project. So I can give the origin story of sort of how this project came to be. If you're following us on Instagram and Facebook, you hope maybe you saw some of those emails, those early emails that I posted that Stephen and I had back and forth. But I want to hear first the origin of this play, which has never been called Little Montgomery before. That's just what we're calling it for right. The podcast series. Give us sort of the backstory of the play, the history of the play, production history, the title changes. Give us the origin story of Little Montgomery.
The real origin is that I was going through 2 years of really bad writer's block. I had just written my first like real play. And I was starting to get my first real attention from people. And I was really excited. And so I put like a ton of pressure on myself to make the next play I wrote just like, you know, amazing and catapult my career even more. And I just destroyed my psyche completely, basically is what it is. And I couldn't write anymore. And it lasted for so long. And it was so depressing. It was so terrible. I basically stopped talking to anybody. This is a weird detail of it, but I was so depressed at one point that I watched the movie Moneyball every day for 2 months because it was the only thing that made me happy.
Oh, geez, and, it's a great movie.
It's a great movie. And the only person I would really talk to was my best friend, this incredible playwright named Frank Winters. And every day he would call me, he would text me, and he would say the funniest stuff to make me feel better about myself. Like, to just come up with like the silliest nicknames to call me or like the funniest terms to tell me like how great of a person I am, just to get me through it. And then eventually after those 2 years, I was like, you know what? I don't even care about my playwriting career anymore. Like I don't have a career. Like I haven't sent anybody anything for 2 years. I haven't been writing. And I was like, I'm just going to write something that feels like fun, that like I would want to watch. And I'm really obsessed with the Coen brothers. I love the way that they blend different kinds of tones and moods, and they can have like, you know, very like wacky crime comedies that can also be incredibly serious and violent. And so I had these two characters in my mind that had just been like sitting in my head for a while talking. And that's usually how a play starts, is like characters will enter my mind and they'll just start talking and they'll have like a rapport, and I won't know who they are. But I'll find them like amusing and they'll like keep coming up. And so I had the characters of Megan and Kimmy, these two 14-year-old girls, together in my head for like 3 months. And I didn't know what they were doing. And then I remember I was like watching all these plays and stuff that had music in them. And I was like, God, I would love to write a play that had like music in it where I got to write some original songs. So I had those two things swirling in my mind. And I'm a huge fan of Coen Brothers. And I was watching some movie and then like a lightning bolt, I swear to God, it hit me. I was like, they kidnapped somebody. I was like, 2 14-year-old girls kidnapped somebody. And I was like, that is what the play is. Yeah. And I was like, who they kidnapped? And like an answer popped in my mind. It was like some singer, some musician, somebody. Yeah. And I was like, okay, what do you hate? I was like, country music. I hate country music. I was like, done. This is what we got. And I immediately like ran to my room. I had this like jolt of energy and I wrote the first scene just like in a flash. And I was like, two girls were best friends going to kidnap some guy. And then I was like, what is the rest of the play? And I was like, well, if they're committing a crime, there has to be cops. So I wrote the next scene immediately, which is basically almost a verbatim conversation between my best friend and I, where it's one guy trying to encourage his really depressed friend.
Right.
And so that's really how the play started. And, you know, I'm a big proponent nowadays of writing on instinct and not outlining a play, because your instincts know you better than you know yourself. Your instincts are going to sort of like write the truth of what you want to write without you knowing it. And so I was like, I'm just going to write this play based on kind of what my instincts tell me, and we'll go from there. And like, I didn't even really know that Rick Montgomery was Megan's real father until I got to that scene where it happens. Wow. I had no idea what was going on. And my instinct was like, you're probably dealing with some kind of like issues with feeling like you have a lack of belonging in your life. Like you're lonely, like you're looking for a place where you fit in.
You're also a huge Star Wars fan.
A huge Star Wars fan.
A father reveal is always around the corner somewhere.
Oh, it's wonderful every time it happens. And like really before I knew it, the play ended up being so much about friendship, yeah, as a form of family. And about us trying to find out who we belong with in life. Mm. And I felt like that was the thing that I had been suffering through for the 2 years before that, is I was just like so lonely and so like upset with myself. And the one kind of beacon of light in my life was my best friend, who helped me through so much. And so I think that's why so much of those themes are in the play. Like I couldn't really even help myself or predict that that's how it was going to go, but it did.
And so this play is called Country Girls. It's been called Montgomery. It's had a couple productions. Yes. It's had some readings. What's the production history?
Yeah. So this is actually interesting. So when I finished the first draft of this play, you know, I said that I was going to write a play that's just like, that I like, that's just for me, that, you know, I don't really care about my career anymore. But once I finished it, I was like, I'm back, baby.
Yes.
Because the play that I wrote before that, that actually got me some attention, you know, I liked it, but I didn't love it. And like there was always pieces of it that were like wrong. Like it took me like so long to write that play to like really get it right. And so this play, I feel like I got right very quickly in the first draft. I was like, this is popping and zinging. It's funny. I like it. Like I can't wait to show this to the world. And I sent it out to like all these competitions and contests, sent it to all these theaters. I was like, oh, just wait for like the wave of acceptance that's gonna flow in. And I got like flatly rejected from every single thing, like didn't even make it to like the next round of anything. I was like, what? Are you kidding me? I was like, not even a second round of anything? And at that point, I thought my taste was just like really off. I was like, do I not know what theater is anymore? Do I not know what writing is? This is crazy.
Am I a bad writer?
Am I like a terrible writer and I have no idea? So like, and that went on for like a year and a half, and that was incredibly disheartening. That was really disheartening. And then I found out that I wasn't sending it to the right people. Mm. You know, this play is not meant for New York audiences. It's not meant for Chicago audiences. It's really meant for like Southern regional theaters. Mm. Because once I started sending it to those theaters, all of a sudden, I was getting readings and productions. There's this amazing theater called Bristol Valley Theater up in upstate New York, in a very small town called Naples. And it was they have like a competition every year, and so it won that competition, and they gave it a production up there for like 2 weekends. So I went up there and it was just like this amazing production. Like everyone who was in it was so good. There's this amazing woman named Karen Bowerstock who runs that theater up there. It's so cool. And then like immediately after that, it won the competition at Trustis Theater. And so I went down there for their production. Also an amazing theater. Like both places have just like such a cool theater community. of people who really rally around those theaters and love the work that they do. Mm-hmm. And so the people that work there are also amazing and like really do it for the work. Mm-hmm. So like, that was a lot of fun. And then I got a reading over at Barter Theater in Virginia, and they were set to produce it. Actually, like right now, it's supposed to be going on right now.
Yeah.
Of course, the pandemic happened.
Instead, you got a podcast.
Instead, I got a podcast, baby. And so, how we ended up here is that Tim, you were we worked on another show together. My play, Everything Is Super Great, down at Theater Lab, and I feel like we clicked kind of immediately.
Oh yeah.
As far as like just the kinds of things that we're interested in theater, the kind of stories we like, just our sensibilities.
Your voice as a writer, I just like hear it and feel it. I just, oh, I love it.
And I feel like you in particular are just an actor who just like fits into the worlds that I create. Like I talked before about characters just appearing in my head and talking.
I want to be your John Goodman so bad. Just make me your John Goodman.
But that's what I mean. Like the Coen brothers, they go back to the same actors all the time because they fit into their worlds perfectly. Yep. I feel like you fit into my worlds perfectly. like you playing
the sweetest
Dave,
thing I've ever heard.
I was like, oh, the second I heard you start reading when we went to our first rehearsal for the very first reading of that play, I was like, oh my God, this guy, he just is the character. He is the character. And so I was like, he is absolutely this other character that I've written as well. I got to send him this other play that I've written called Montgomery. Yeah. And then I sent it to you and here we are now.
January of 2019, you sent me that. That was when we did the reading at Theater Lab, for those of you who may not know, Theater Lab is a company up in Boca Raton, Florida. We're New City Players is down in Fort Lauderdale, but Matt Stabile's the artistic director up there, and him and I are good friends. And
Shout out to Theater Lab and Matt.
Theater Lab guys rules.
Are so great.
Yeah, that team is awesome. That whole team up there is really great, really inspiring, and been great for me. And Matt's become like one of those friend mentor people, you know, where it's like we can be friends and we're equals, but I can also go to him and be like, running a theater company in South Florida. Boo. And he's just been huge. But that play was so much fun.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
It's just such a funny play, such a fun character.
Which
Matt directed. Yes. Yes. And so that was a year ago, or a little more than a year ago. I guess that was November, December when we did the full production of 2019. Yeah. And then obviously a few months later, COVID-19 pandemic hits, and my mind immediately, and it's middle of March, I'm like, okay, what are we going to do? What can we do? I'm a huge podcast fan. Maybe there's a play out there, someone I know who I could turn into a podcast. And somehow I remembered, I was like, oh my God, Steve, you know, I have a little folder on my desktop that just says scripts. And it's like scripts that people have sent me that I need to read that I haven't read, which every producer knows this conundrum. Just like getting sent scripts and you're supposed to read them and blah. And it was literally the first script of that group of,
really?
Of like, I'm dead serious. And I like could not believe it. So I picked that script up and I read it. And immediately I was like, oh my God, this just like fell from heaven into my lap. It is the perfect show to be turned into a podcast, audio play, radio play, whatever you want to call it. And so I sent it over to Ryan Maloney, our associate artistic director, for him to read and get his feedback. And he agreed. He was like, this is perfect. This is great. And like, I emailed you on April 30th. And we went back and forth. We talked on the phone the next day and you were like, yes, let's do this. 2 weeks later, it was cast. 2 weeks later, we were doing it.
Crazy. It's like, that's still so crazy to me.
It is really crazy. So what I wanted to ask you is, what was that? You know, there's my side of the story, which was like, you know, someone desperately looking for a play and finding the perfect thing. You know, my perception of you on my side was like, Steven is just green light. He wants to do this. He's, you know, become a friend, super easy to work with. I love his play. And he's just saying yes to everything. On your end, what was it like? Pandemic begins. What is going on? What is going on with you as a writer at the time that email comes in? What are you thinking at the sort of the onset of this project?
You know, I was also I was going through through somewhat of another writer's slump in my life. I had had like another setback as a writer, not necessarily writer's block, but I had gotten my hopes up about something. Basically, like I had this play that I wrote, this other play that I wrote, and I was so excited about it. And very similar to the experience with Montgomery, where I wrote it, I was like, this is great, I'm going to send it out. Yeah. And very similarly, it was just like pure rejection. and the horrible thing is like, I went out to LA to meet with TV managers, which I saw as like the next step in my career. I was like, okay, yeah. I'm going to write a bunch of plays. I'm going to get them to a state where they're getting produced. I'm going to use those productions to get an agent. And then I'm going to get my agent to help me meet TV managers. And then I'm going to get a TV job. And like, that's just how the progression is going to go.
Yep.
So I did all that. But then the play I had them use as my sample was this new play. And I got out to LA and I had this one meeting with this manager, and he was like, yeah, you know, the play you wrote basically like wasn't very good. He was like, no. It's really not right for TV. And halfway through the meeting, I was like, why am I in this meeting then? And I have no idea why he met with me. I assume it was like as a favor to my agent, maybe. Yeah. But then I was just like in LA for like a week and I had no more meetings. And I went home and I was just like, and that's when I figured out like, oh, the play I wrote wasn't very good.
Oh, he was right.
but then amazingly, I had three productions lined up for that fall, one of which is the one that we did together, which were all like so great. You know, it's the dream to be in production. But yeah. All I wanted to do as a writer was like write a new play so that I could fix the mistake that I just did, right? But I couldn't write because I was doing rewrites for other stuff. I was in meetings. I was in rehearsals. So I spent like 4 months not writing anything. And that took me to January. And in January, I was still in this state where I was like, you know, I haven't written anything new that was good in like a year now. Do I still have it? Which is like, I'm sure the fear of every writer, definitely, but I'm sure the fear of every
artist. Actor. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. At any moment, it could all be gone. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. Just paranoid all the time.
Paranoid all the time.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh my God, is this it? Is this, am I over? Am I done? And so, you know, I started working on something else, which was like, so that took me to January. So then I was working on a new play. And, you know, there were some scenes in it, in the new play, that were like really good. I was like, no, like I still have it. Like there's some stuff in here that's really rocking, but like half of the play I didn't care at all about. I was like, this isn't very good, but half of it is good. So I need to figure out what's going on with that. But because I didn't want to like make a false move, because I didn't want to like, I was still in such a delicate state of mind. I was still like, if I mess up this play, like there might be no coming back for my confidence.
Oh gosh.
And so I was like, I can't like force the play. Because it's not quite working. I can't like force it. Cause I could, if I force it too much, then like I'll ruin it. Like I won't be able to figure out, how to fix it. And so I was kind of like delaying all that. And the pandemic started. So like I was indoors all the time and I can't write at home. I'm really bad at writing at home. I have to go to a coffee shop. I have to be around other people.
Yep.
And, obviously I couldn't do that. Because for listeners, I live in New York, so like we got hit first.
Yeah.
So it was also kind of like scary. All that's going on. Like I'm in a delicate state. I'm not writing. I can't go anywhere. I'm indoors. It's still cold out. And then I get an email from Tim.
Yes.
So the second that you were like, "Let's do this thing," you've already written that you really like. I was like, "Hell yeah!" Are you kidding? Absolutely, I want to do that.
So what was the adaptation process? Because we worked pretty quick and you You know, like I said, it was pretty close to being audio ready. And yeah. I had a few notes of things to change. But then you came back, obviously, with much more knowledge of the play. And I think I'd read it twice when I reached out to you. You had way more knowledge of the play than I ever did. And you came back with all of these other ideas of like, let me change this a little bit. Let me rewrite this. Let me alter this. A lot of it having to do with adapting it to audio format. But some of it, you were just kind of like in a bit of a rewriting phase and rewrote a couple things, rewrote a couple moments. What was that process like, the adaptation process?
Oh, it was fascinating. It was so fascinating. And I feel like I'm learning even more now that it's coming out and I'm listening to the episodes. I'm like, oh man, we did a good job here. Here, I feel like I could have done a better job. Like there were some things where I just...
Yeah.
I knew that I basically had to make the moments that were very physical on stage be able to make sense for someone who's just listening to it.
Right.
There are some scenes that are just talking, and mm-hmm. that, and like that works perfectly. I didn't have to do much for that. Like other stuff, you know, in the scene where Kimmy sings her song, and then Megan comes back in the room, and there's like a little fight that goes on.
Yeah.
You know, like he grabs a hammer, yep. Megan grabs a little cow. And like on stage, it's so much fun to do that. But I was like,
of course,
how are we going to get through this?
Yeah, it's definitely a play that was turned into a podcast. We definitely lost a couple things, but I don't think any of it to the detriment of the story, but more to we lost some of the physical comedy that is in there.
But I think that's totally fine. I mean,
yeah,
I think most of my rewriting process was. One was that I was thinking of the production that had happened at Trustis Theater, and mm-hmm. I saw a change at the end that I wanted to make there. So I made that. And then most of it was just like seeing how we can make the physical work in the audio world, basically.
Yeah.
But I think that the cool thing for me personally, and I think less for the project, was I was like, oh, wow, like the audio format is really cool. And there's a lot of really cool things that you can do in this format that you actually can't do on stage.
Like what? What do you think?
You know, I've been listening to a lot. I've been watching a lot of horror lately and a lot of like thriller stuff. You know, we've been talking a little bit about this like idea that I've been having that mm-hmm. involves like, you know, like a crime thriller that's mixed with kind of like a terror play. But I think, you know, because it's an audio format, you can do things where if the only thing you as the listener or as the audience member can get is the audio of something, your imagination then runs wild, you know? And the nature of horror and terror is that like, something is scary because it's unknowable, because you don't know what the monster is. And that lends itself so well to the audio format.
Yeah.
And so I've been thinking so much about like the different ways that you can have like a terror audio play or a terror podcast that can be absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
Specifically because it's in the audio format.
Right.
And you can't see like who the bad guy is.
Right. Do you think something like that needs to be experienced more like an event? Like you were just describing that and I was like, oh, how cool would it be to just get everyone in a room, make it pitch black, and then listen to an audio play versus so much of podcast culture is it's passive consumption. You know, it's while I'm driving, while I'm on the subway, doing the dishes, going for a run. You know, it's listening while you're doing other things. Do you feel like that could still play in sort of the I'm doing two things at once?
That's a great question.
It would be really cool to just like we're going in a pitch black room and having a listening
incredible.
Party.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, that's a fun
idea. I'm thinking of my experience where I've been going on a lot of bike rides lately.
Okay.
And usually at the end of my bike ride, it'll be like dark out. So I'll be biking, you know, back home in the dark. And I've been listening to this one podcast series called Radio Rental, where it's these people telling these stories, these true stories that happened to them. And it's not like, you know, like I got mugged or like, you know, I like something really bad happened to me. It's like something bad almost happened to them. Mm. It's like a, it's like this feeling of terror that follows them. And listening to those were scary as hell.
Even when you're just riding your bike around.
Even when I'm just riding my bike, even when I'm just walking. Because like I think it's because the storytelling with that is so good that it has me hooked. Yeah. I mean, I'm absolutely hooked with these stories. And I think like that's what so you cool. need to turn, you know, a podcast into a really good podcast. Because I've tried listening to some fictional podcasts and they just don't hook me the way I want them to.
Yeah.
And because of that, it turns into passive listening. It turns into I'm at the gym and I have it playing and I, you know, pop in and out of actually listening.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think like this project mixed with learning more and more about what the audio format can really do has me really thinking about like what is the best story that can be told really through the audio format.
Yeah, it is that weird. I feel like a lot of audio consumption has to do with I'm looking to gather information or I'm looking to be lightly entertained. So it's like, oh, this celebrity that I like or this TV show that I like, you know, they started a podcast. Let me listen to them interview their other celebrity friends.
Right.
You know, it's this that weird vicarious living through famous people's lives so we can feel close to it BS that all of us do to some degree. Or it's like, I'm really interested in the subject and I'm just like learning, you know, it's very kind of an intellectual exercise, but to really, as like a storytelling medium, you know, you sit down to watch a TV show or a film, you go somewhere and sit down to watch a play. There's a intentionality of attention that is required of you to even engage in those mediums. Whereas the audio format doesn't have that, which is why I think like the live radio play thing, which I did a live radio play. There was a group that used to do a ton of them down here. Matt Stabile was actually very involved with them. Did like a live radio play of an Orson Welles piece.
Oh, cool.
And all of the sounds and all the sound effects are done live on stage by like a percussion guy. And he's got all these gadgets and trinkets that make noises and the actors step up to the microphones. And
oh, wow.
You know, it's like, it's really interesting, but everything you were just describing, like my imagination was just like that idea of the pitch black room, like people come for an audio experience. And, you know, then my producer brain kicks in and it's like, God, this would be so cheap to produce, you know, it's just like an empty black room. And maybe you incorporate some lighting cues too. You know, do some flashes. Maybe there are some actors who are there and they're in poses or some sort of interpretive thing, but it's mostly just a pure audio experience sitting in the dark, kind of spooky. It just seems like there's a ton of potential to turn it into an event because it is so often a passive consumption type of thing. So
yeah. And it's also
keep talking
like,
off air, huh?
Like it's also like, I was, I just wrote this new play, like 2 weeks ago where I was trying to play with some of these ideas we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
And in the opening scene of one of them, it's a 911 call, and it's like a 20-minute scene. But the only thing you're seeing on stage is this woman at this desk who is talking to this person. But you can hear it over, like you would hear it over, I guess, like, you know, like over the audience.
Yeah.
And it's like this terrifying scene that I took from like a real live 911 call that I listened to on YouTube because I'm weird like that.
Yeah.
And like, it's like a terrifying scene because of what's happening, but there's like a juxtaposition there of like in like intense, just like stillness on stage. Mm. And there's something that's terrifying about that of like not having what you're seeing match up to what you're listening to.
Wow.
And I feel like that can match really well with the audio format of like, just being someone who's still and listening, but what you're listening to is absolutely terrifying. Like there's something that is really right. fascinating about that to me.
Yeah. And the images on the stage are, I don't even know what, you know, they're enhancing the audio experience, but they're also potentially distracting from it. They're, you know, but in right. distracting in like a leading you down a certain path so that you can be surprised. It's almost like a new form of entertainment in here somewhere that we're encroaching upon.
Yeah, man. Like I felt this for a while is like, I think podcasts are great. I listen to a lot of podcasts, yeah. but I don't feel like there are that many good fictional podcasts. And I feel like it's a huge arena that we're about to move into mm-hmm. as a culture. I think yeah. that they're going to be huge. And I think we're really learning that right now because we don't have theater, because there yeah. aren't that many TV shows or movies coming out. And I think we're like really learning how to do this. I think like in the next 2 years, you're going to see just an explosion of really great fictional podcast series.
Yeah, totally. So what was your favorite part about working with New City Players on this project, the process of adapting and changing up and then doing rehearsals with us and being there for the recordings as well? What was the most exciting, or what part did you love the most about that whole experience?
Oh, man. This is going to sound a lot like I am just trying to like flatter you or compliment your company.
Are you buttering my bread?
But so up in New York, you know, I've been up here for 10 years now. I've worked at several companies, and then I've been a playwright with a couple different companies. And I really found that like one thing that I really missed from like, you know, growing up and doing theater at your school, where it's like a good mm-hmm. community where you're with your friends.
Yeah.
And being in New York is like, I didn't see that at many companies. You know, people would show up to work, it's a job, and then you go home. But I was, one theater I worked at is called the Ensemble Studio Theater up here. And I love them. And I stayed working with them for a couple different years. And then I joined their playwriting group as a playwright. That's actually where I met my wife. And that place I absolutely love. It is my theatrical home here because it is yeah. a community. Because yeah. you see and work with all the same actors and directors all the time. Because you would go to work there in the administrative offices, and you know, actors or people in the community would just show up to work just to like say hi, just to, you know, go to lunch with you. It really felt like the community that you have growing up and doing theater. It's like the reason why you love to do theater.
Yeah.
I haven't really seen that anywhere else until I came down to South Florida. And, you know, yeah. I saw it with Theater Lab, with like yep. the way that everyone knew each other and the way that everyone worked at all the same theaters. And I was wondering, is it just Theater Lab? Until I got to work with you on this project. And like the way that you all knew each other and were like such good friends and knew everybody at Theater Lab as well. But just like the kindness and the warmth that every single person in the cast had every day of the project. I was like, this is incredible. Like, I just love showing up to rehearsal to hang out with these people.
Yeah.
Like, it's so much fun getting to just like work on a piece of theater with people that you really like. There's really almost nothing better than that.
It is. It's the truth. It's why me and some friends started a company. You know, it's yeah. like, yeah. it's one thing to sort of do the gig life and yeah, you clock in, you do your acting job and you leave. But doing theater with your friends, it's almost like you're cheating life a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, if you can figure out how to get paid to do it, which is the hardest part.
Right.
And I still haven't quite figured it out. Hence, you know, other sources of income. But if you can figure out how to make a living you really are kind of hacking life, because it is plain make-believe with your friends. If you sort of lean into, I'm going to have a home base, I'm going to have a community, I'm going to have a group or a region that I work in and get to know and build those friendships.
Yeah.
Gosh, because, you just can't beat it.
Because it adds to the art that you're making.
Yeah.
You know, like when we were in rehearsals, like, yes, I was rehearsing and I was like, you know, how can we make this moment as best as it can be? Mm-hmm. But in the back of my brain, I was like, oh my gosh. You know, like Casey Sacco would be so great if I could write like this part for her and something. Or Elizabeth Price, she would fit into like so many characters I've already thought of.
Yeah.
Like how, and so like as we were rehearsing, I was like, oh my gosh, what can I write for these people to do that is like written for them?
Oh,
like how much
gosh.
Fun would that be, you know?
Oh.
And I think like that is really what the dream is.
That's all an actor ever wants to hear. The idea that someone would write something for them, it's just like, it's the most flattering and fun thing to experience as an actor. So I know when they listen to this, they're going to be so happy.
But that was the other cool thing about it, man. It's like, you know, showing up to a rehearsal space. Here's something that I'll say for people who aren't writers or playwrights is, you know, for writing, the way that I try to describe it to a friend of mine who is not in theater at all, is I was like, when you write a play, you're essentially writing your heart out. You're putting your heart on the page and giving it to somebody to read. It's sort of like telling somebody that you love them and asking if they will love you back if given this thing.
Yeah.
And giving somebody a script that you've written to read is like giving them your diary and having them read it as best they can for total strangers. You know what I mean? It's like a very terrifying experience.
Yeah, it is.
So you never know what's going to happen when you show up in a rehearsal room. Mm-hmm. If somebody does not understand what you've written, sometimes it's hard to get to a place where you can move forward.
Right. Well, yeah, you just got to like let it go.
And so showing up for rehearsal with people that I did not know other than you.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very scary experience. And then like seeing them really show their talent and do what they could do. And for me to think like, oh man, these people are so talented. Like what could I do that like, what can I write that I would love that would like be fit perfectly for them? Like, I don't feel that way ever. Like that's a rare thing for me,
right.
For me to feel like to be in a room with people that I'm so inspired by, yeah. Be like, oh my gosh, they're going to make me look so good if I can write something else that's like specifically meant for them.
Well, I agree that that whole process, it also just came at a really good time when we were like a lot of uncertainty. We were several weeks into all of this, you know, a couple months into COVID-19 lockdown, and everyone's kind of freaking out. To have a project to come to for a few hours, for a few weeks, every single day. And then everyone, like you said, being so enjoyable and kind and just like fun, you know,
yeah.
Pretty much all of us just like jokesters, like just under the surface, like most of us are just ready to crack a joke at any second. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Who's your favorite character in the play and why?
Oh man. Oh, that's hard. That's so hard. I love all of them so much.
Yeah.
it's gotta be your character, Tim.
Get out of here. Stop it.
Your character.
Because that's your friend. Because that's your best friend.
Well,
right?
it's that character is a combination. Both him and Larry are a combination of me and my friend together.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was going to say Kimmy because Kimmy is one of my favorite characters of all time.
Yeah.
But Chet is the most like me of any character that I've ever written. And so writing him and watching people like respond to him is like watching people respond to like who I really am.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, he's a guy who just like has such a he has such like a positive spirit. He's just like such a, and there's such a like a naivete. He's probably not me as I am right now. He's probably me as I was when I was like, you know, like 18. Like just so bright eyed and think
back
the world.
Before the LA managers beat you into the ground.
Yeah. back before I moved to New York and became very poor and cold all the time. Yeah, there's something there. There's a spirit in him and an optimism that I just like really, really love. And that's why I wanted you to play him, Tim.
that was interesting when you gave me the play. It wasn't because you knew that I had a theater, but you didn't know anything about New City Players. You sent me that play as like a, I think you'd be really good for this character.
Yeah.
And it was like that. Oh, someone knows me as an actor, not as the New City Players guy. And it was such a warm and gooey feeling. And both characters of yours that I've played, I just so deeply love both of them, Dave and Chet. There's just, there's a purity to both of them that I love. I don't know how else to say it. I'm just like, I have such a soft spot for them. Cause similarly, I think there is a part of me that's kind of like that in certain settings, but I wish I was more like them in certain ways, you know, that optimism, you know, to a fault sometimes.
Definitely to a fault.
What is your advice to young playwrights? We just got a couple more questions I want to ask you. What's your advice to young playwrights in their 20s, maybe?
Yeah, man. Read every play you can find, basically. Mm. That is my number one piece of advice. I took a playwriting class in college. My very first playwriting mentor is an amazing playwright named Sheila Rainier, who taught me all the basics. So that was very helpful. Like, you know, here's conflict. Here's how a play is structured. And here are like a couple quick exercises for you to like figure out how to do that. So I think like maybe an intro course is a good idea. But more than anything, like what you need to do is figure out what works in plays. And there's no better way to do that than to just like read a ton of plays and go see as much theater as you can. Yeah. And then I think ask yourself, like, what do you really like? And I think this is something that's very hard for writers to figure out, because like when I moved to New York, I knew I loved writing, but I really wanted to like fit in. I wanted to be successful. I wanted to be a playwright in New York. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a lot of plays that I thought were good and that I wanted to emulate because there was something
good for other
good
people, kind
They're
of
good for other people. But what I did is I ignored like my voice. Like somewhere in there was somebody who wanted to write a different kind of play, like a different kind of story, but I didn't see that on stage. So I wasn't going to go do that. And what I've really learned over the years is like, you really just got to write the stuff that you want to write, you know, because like every playwright who has their own voice, you know, like Lucas Naith writes specifically Lucas Naith plays. Mm-hmm. Annie Baker writes specifically Annie Baker plays. Like they created their voices because they wrote not what someone else wrote, but they wrote what they really liked. And over the years, like they found their voice. So read as much as you can and then figure out like what you like and then just write the thing that makes you the happiest or makes you the most terrified or like just like really like lights you on fire.
That's such good advice. Ah, it's great, great advice.
And like, I know that that's pretty basic advice, like, you know, like read and write a bunch, but that's pretty much what it is. Like there's no secret formula. There's no course you're going to take that's going to turn you into a great playwright. You know, you know, plays that are like write by numbers are predictable and boring. Like, you're going to go to the theater and you're going to know how it's going to end because it's going to follow a formula.
Yeah.
Like, what you should be in search of is writing the play that you love the most, you know? So like, if you're writing and you're like, I'm writing the play that I love and it is bad, that's okay. That's okay. It's going to take a while to become a good writer. Yeah. You know, like Ira Glass has that great quote, which is like, you know, if you're an artist and you're starting out, your taste in art may be incredible. You may be, you may have the best taste of anyone, but your craft hasn't matched it yet. There's a gap there. So you just need to continue working until you close that gap between your craft and your taste. And that's why I say,
I feel
like,
that. Whew, I feel that.
Yeah, man. That's why I say, like, write the thing that you love the most, because even if it's not good the first time and it's not that great the second time, like, it's going to get good. And then you're going to reach the point where you're writing only your voice. And I think that that is very important.
Yeah, it does seem to be like that's really the only thing any of us have. And you could apply this to other fields besides playwriting and even outside of the arts. It's like the only thing any of us really have is what's going on inside of us and what we think and feel about it and what things excite us or interest us or frighten us.
Yeah.
And it is so easy to want to, and I struggle with this in all areas as a producer, as an actor, as a director, even trying to write some things recently. It's like you're constantly trying to think, what do I need to do something that like is valuable to the audience, is valuable to the to the listener, to the viewer. Like, if they don't like it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how I feel about it. Like, they have to accept it, and they have to, you know, that's the only way that's going to get traction and find an audience, blah blah blah. But it's like none of that is real.
Right.
It's just like it's like your idea of what people want. All we really have is what's already inside of us, and sort of trusting that and being able to work through the quote unquote failures along the way, whatever that looks like, and learning from them. It's like, gosh, that's all we got.
And I think, like, if you're like, this has happened to me a couple of times where you reach a place where, like, you really want to be a writer. And in order to do that, you need to make money as a writer. So that means, like, writing the thing that you think is going to be successful.
Yeah.
And I've fallen into that trap where I was like, I thought of an idea and I was like, this idea has not been on the stage before.
I'm gonna commercial value.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Yeah. And as I'm writing it, I'm like, yeah, okay. So, like, I don't enjoy writing this play. I'm not enjoying this, but, like, you know, once I get it on stage, it'll have value because, you know, I'll get more notice or whatever.
And then I can write the thing that I want.
Right,
write.
Right. But then I was like, why am I doing this? Like, why did I pursue this life to write something I don't even like? What? Yeah. Like, how far off track have I gone? You know?
Right. So my last question for you, Stephen, is it's October 30th. We're going to release this podcast a week from now, our little bonus episode here. What are you looking forward to? What are you hopeful about? What's your word of encouragement to audiences and storytellers? give us something to hold on to as we keep creating and keep thinking about new ways to tell stories while we're in lockdowns and pseudo lockdowns and second and third waves of this pandemic. You know, what are you looking forward to, and what can you give us as some hope? No pressure, just, you know, give us some hope.
You know, I was thinking a lot about before the pandemic, and my wife and I, you know, we're very involved in the theater community up here where we live. And, you know, every Friday, every Saturday, you know, we would always go to, like, friends' readings. We would go to friends' shows. We were always so busy, and it reached a point where we were, like, too busy, and, like, you start to to be like, oh God, I love this person, but like, I don't want to go see their show. I'm sure it's good. Yep. I don't want to go see it. I just want to like sit in and not do anything.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's going to be great is when this is all over and we do get back into rooms with each other and we do start watching stories, I think it is going to be a renaissance like we have never experienced, and maybe no one for the past several generations have experienced, because we're gonna rediscover theater for the first time in like who knows how many generations. This is the longest I think anybody's ever gone without doing theater or being in a theater. So I think like the endorphin rush we're going to get just by like seeing our friends and being in a theater and witnessing a story live in front of us when we haven't seen like anybody for like a year. Yeah. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be the best euphoric feeling we've ever had.
Yeah.
So I think like, and I think that's going to create an explosion of art, like that happiness, that joy that we're going to experience. It is going to be like, it's going to be unlike anything we've ever had. And that is something to look forward to.
Well, Stephen, it has been a pleasure getting to know you, getting to work with you twice now, this conversation for the last hour or so. I can't wait for what's next for you as a writer. I am a huge fan. Anything you do that I can have access to, I will read it. I will come see it. You know, I am a huge fan and I can't wait to see what's next for you. And thank you for letting us do your play and for partnering with us and coming on the podcast and chopping it up with me today.
No, Tim, thank you, man. You know, you really provided a light in the darkness for me with this project. It was so great to work with you and everyone else down at New City Players. And trust me, man, I've been thinking and coming up with a lot of ideas for the next project that we can work on together.
So, woo! Can't wait.
Hopefully it'll all come together soon.
I love it. Oh, can't wait, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, man.